Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Manuela Zaragoza. Welcome to In the Balance, the discussion programme from the BBC's business team. This week, nearly 3,000 leaders from business, government, international organisations, academia, media and the arts gathered in Davos in Switzerland for the annual World Economic Forum. On the agenda was the return to faster global economic growth and how to make sure everyone benefits from all that growth. Well, President Trump told Davos delegates, everyone does.
When the United States grows, so does the world. American prosperity has created countless jobs all around the globe, and the drive for excellence, creativity, and innovation in the U.S. has led to important discoveries that help people everywhere live more prosperous and far healthier lives.
But elsewhere, a narrative persists that inequality is getting worse, that the rich are getting richer and the middle class is losing out. Is that really the case? And if so, what can be done about it? That's what our guests will be discussing today, so let me introduce them. Speaking to us from the World Economic Forum in Davos is Minouche Shafik, director of the London School of Economics and Political Science and a former deputy governor of the Bank of England, the UK's central bank. Also in Davos with Minouche is Kishore Mahbubani, formerly Dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore. He's also served many years as a diplomat for Singapore and is a recognised expert on Asian and world affairs. Here in the studio with me in London is Eve Poole, author of a book called Capitalism's Toxic Assumptions. And joining us from our Washington studio is Desmond Lachman. He's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a think tank in the US supporting free enterprise. He's also a former deputy director at the International Monetary Fund. Manoush, I wanted to start with you. The theme at Davos this year is strengthening cooperation in a fractured world. And I'm quoting there. This idea of growing inequality, let's get the facts first straight about that. Is global inequality really on the rise?
Well, inequality between countries has actually reduced in recent years. And that's mainly because of the enormous growth we've seen in China, but also elsewhere in Asia. But where we have seen a rise in inequality is within countries, particularly in the advanced economies, but also in many emerging markets. We've seen a divergence in economic outcomes.
And which metric are you looking at? Because there are so many ways of measuring inequality.
Well, the most common metric is something called the Gini coefficient, which looks at the incomes of the bottom of the income bracket to the top. And it's a very commonly used measure of the distribution of income across society.
Desmond Lachman, there is confusion, isn't there, and a lot of debate about how to measure inequality.
There certainly is. I would add that something that has occurred, particularly after 2008, and in reflection of the way in which monetary policy was run in the main countries, is that there has been a huge increase in wealth, which is shared by people in the upper income bracket. So I'm talking about, for instance, the global stock market boom that has been fueled by a huge amount of money printing. So what the perception, certainly in the United States, is that the main beneficiaries of these kind of policies have been Wall Street rather than Main Street. So while wages have been stagnating, the median wage in the United States has stagnated for the last 20 years, there's been a massive increase in wealth by those who actually own equities, or either directly or indirectly. So I think that one would have to take into account not simply income, but also what is occurring with wealth.
Eve, is that how you see it?
Well, I think Oxfam's Global Inequality Report, just out to chime in with Davos, does make the point that 82% of the global wealth is in the hands of the 1%. So while the bottom 50% are doing better than thought, so the level of poverty seems to be lifting slightly, there is this issue that global inequality in terms of the gap between rich and poor is accelerating and getting a lot worse. And as our friend in Washington says, Desmond, this is one of the problems that Piketty pointed out, that because...
This is Thomas Piketty.
That's right.
Who wrote this seminal work on inequality recently.
Exactly. And he points out that this sort of inequality has a tendency to accelerate because the rates of capital return outstrip economic growth. So those who are already rich just get exponentially richer, and therefore that gap will increase exponentially unless something is done about it.
And Keisha, what's your position on the whole sort of how to define inequality, whether or not it's getting worse?
Certainly the facts are there that inequality in the advanced societies, as Minhas said, is getting worse. Inequality maybe in China is getting worse. But to balance all that, I think it's very important to emphasize that the last 30 years have been the best 30 years for the bottom half of the world's population. We've never seen such a dramatic reduction of absolute poverty as we have in the last 30 years. China alone, the figures vary from 500 to 800 million people have been rescued from absolute poverty. And in fact, Nicholas Kristof of New York Times came up with a column recently saying that 2017 was probably the best year ever in human history, because every day the number of people around the world living in extreme poverty, less than $2 a day, goes down by 217,000 per day. That's roughly about 80 million a year. So that part of the story, and something which I have seen and experienced myself living in Singapore for the last 50 years, it's another important part of the story that's got to balance the inequality narrative, which I think is dominating the Western airwaves.
But why does it feel so bad? I mean, around the world, you hear again and again that inequality is getting worse. Yet, as you say, there are equally economists out there saying, well, actually, things are much better than they've ever been.
I know, I travel often to China and India. In fact, I was in India last week and I was in China 2 months ago. The feeling of the people there is very different. It is true that inequality is growing, but you know, from the point of view of the Chinese people, in terms of access to electricity, in terms of access to water, and frankly, access to a smartphone, the growth is amazing. From their point of view, they see a daily improvement in their lives. And most of the people, I would say, in China and India believe, and by the way, also in Southeast Asia, ASEAN, believe that their children will have a better life than them, despite the rising inequality. There is, of course, certainly a problem about the 1%. Their share of the wealth is, frankly, grossly unjust, grossly unfair. But the other part of the story is the bottom 50% of the world is also having a relatively good decades, and we should let that part of the story carry on while managing the problem of the 1%.
Minhas, is this something that's coming out in Davos at all, what Kishore is talking about there?
Yes, very much so. And I think there's an added dimension, which is the impact of automation. And many people here are talking about the fact that automation will actually mean that many jobs that are sort of traditionally in the sort of middle income range may disappear, as well as automation of low-skilled jobs. And so the worry is that the economy is actually moving in a direction which may generate even greater inequality. I think the other thing I'd say is, I think more so for the advanced economies, the other dimension to this feeling of injustice is the decline in social mobility. So if you look in many of the advanced economies today, your income is more dependent than before on your parents' income. And so the idea that you can do much better than your parents has declined in many, many countries around the world. I think that is a huge part of the reason why there's a sense of injustice, because the fact that there was social mobility was one of the reasons people were willing to tolerate some inequality if they felt that there was a fair shot to improve their lot.
Eve, we're talking about income wealth inequality here, but what Minhas is mentioning there, I mean, is there an argument for broadening what we mean by inequality? Perhaps we're focusing on the wrong kind of metrics? I don't know.
Well, I think it's really about a narrative of power, because it's not a zero-sum game. It's not that in order to alleviate poverty, you have to strip that wealth from the 1% and immediately transfer it down. It's a bit more granular than that. But the problem about having such an imbalance globally is that the super rich have incredible power. So if they choose, like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, to exercise that power through philanthropy, then that helps. If they don't choose to do that, it doesn't. So I think one of the things, the injustices that people are railing against, which you see in a very small way in Britain around what's happening here at the moment, is about one rule for the rich and one for the poor. So just a very modest statistic from the Department of Work and Pensions. If you think about tax collection and benefit fraud, they've got over 3,000 staff working on investigating benefit frauds, which would only ever bring in about £1 billion.
And that would be welfare fraud for Americans.
Exactly. But they've only got 300 staff investigating corporate tax evasion, which would bring in £70 billion. So the problem is you start seeing is an imbalance in public policy and emphasis and priorities so that the rich get to increasingly keep their benefits. And as we see what's happening with taxation at the moment, have less of a tax burden. And then again, that contributes to this acceleration of this gap between rich and poor.
So Manoush, you're at Davos, you're at the World Economic Forum where these things are being discussed. What solutions are people coming up with?
The biggest thing people are talking about is skills as a sort of panacea policy. And the reason is that if you increase skills, that will mean that people's wages are likely to go up. They'll have more high-skilled jobs, and that will be a benefit. And the other thing is skills is part of the answer to the automation phenomenon. And if parts of jobs are going to be automated, people need new skills to do the new jobs that will be created in the economy. I mean, I think that is a very important part of the story. But I don't think it's enough. I think you need a serious discussion about taxation. You know, we have an economy that is, some call it a superstar economy, where those with very high skills get very high rewards and others don't. And our tax system is making that worse, because if you look at what's happened to taxation over the last 20 years in most countries, top tax rates have been lowered, VAT has gone up. VAT is a very regressive tax. In general, in the OECD countries, tax systems have become less progressive. So they've done a less good job at sharing out some of the benefits.
But has that been mentioned anywhere at Davos? Kishore?
Yeah. And one thing about Davos is you hear lots of world leaders speak, and quite often they're rather boring. Surprisingly, Emmanuel Macron was very inspiring. Clearly, this is a young man who deeply understands the fact that the core problem in France is that the economy hasn't been growing. There's been so much emphasis on distribution and less emphasis on growth. And he actually made a very passionate case without a written text that, you know, at the end of the day, if you really want to promote distribution, you first of all got to make sure that the economy is growing. And so he focused on some of these things and the fact that you've got to retool, reskill the workers. And by the way, this is a universal problem. Singapore has done exceptionally well in the last 50 years. We have one of the highest per capita GNPs in the world. But even Singapore has got to retool its workforce. But I want to add a very important point here, if you don't mind, that it's very important to segment, to some extent, the problems that you get in North America from the problems that you get in Europe. And the problems that, say, for example, you get in developing countries in Asia. And in developing countries in Asia, the emphasis still is and has to be on promoting growth. And, of course, one of the results of promoting growth is that inequality rises. But that's a cost you pay in the short run. And once
that's kind of counterintuitive, isn't it? Growth is encourages inequality.
It is. The most striking example of this is China. And it's actually quite amazing because China is still run by a Communist Party of China, which in theory is supposed to promote greater distribution of wealth. But in China, surprisingly, if I'm right, Manoush, the Gini coefficient has worsened. And so, you know, even in a place like China where you have a Communist Party, the result of a high growth is you've got this incredible inequality. And in China, too, by the way, the country that is now producing the largest number of new billionaires every year is China.
Why is inequality going up?
In the case of the emerging markets, certainly in Southeast Asia and East Asia, the focus is still very much on trying to get as much economic growth as possible, because that economic growth is actually delivering the tremendous poverty reduction that you have seen in Asia over the past few decades. But of course, once you develop a very sizable middle class, and I think to some extent China is getting there, parts of ASEAN is getting there. India is still behind in terms of developing its middle class. But once the middle class comes about, then the spectrum in society changes. And then, frankly, at that point in time, you may want to address more forcefully the question, why is it the top 1% share of the global income has grown so much?
Mm. I should say, though, many low- and middle-income countries now have started to build mechanisms to address this inequality. So in almost every developing country now, you have the beginnings of a social safety net to address this. Things like free school meals, cash transfer schemes have become much more prevalent and incredibly successful. There have been about...
Where are you thinking of?
Across Africa and Asia and in Latin America, in about 100 developing countries now, there are sort of ingredients of a social welfare system. So there is a policy response in many developing countries to try and tackle some of these inequalities.
Eve Poole, we were hearing Manoush earlier say the things being discussed at Davos to address inequality, skills, taxation, are they enough?
I think they're a good start. I mean, taxation is crucial. Skills is possibly a red herring because it depends entirely which skills you mean in terms of what the AI challenge is. But I think there is a larger challenge, which is what's been called the CSR agenda, which is what the purpose of business is.
CSR being?
The Corporate Social Responsibility Agenda. And I know that an awful lot of the leaders at Davos are there because they want everybody to believe, their shareholders in particular, as well as employees, that they as company leaders are very committed to the wider scope of business. Yet they're entirely incentivized around share price and shareholder value. And while we have a system that prioritises that over everything else, and therefore a system that rewards a very, very narrow metric, we're just not going to get the right sort of behaviour that will help. As we've heard, there are an awful lot of developing countries who are doing great things around welfare systems and support and education. Companies can help a lot with that if they see that as a natural part of what they do to invest not only in their future employees but also in their future customers in the context they operate in.
Desmond, what do you make of that?
I certainly agree that tax policy needs changing, that we need to improve skills. But what seems to really be very problematic is the way in which we've got the growth through monetary policy expansion, central banks buying literally trillions of dollars of assets, and in the process, distorting financial markets, creating bubbles, setting up the next stage for the big bust.
But how does that relate directly to growing inequality?
Well, when the bubble bursts, what we see is people's house prices decline, people get thrown out of jobs, people have difficulty getting wage increases, everybody loses, but those at the bottom, if the 2008 experience was anything to go by, those are the ones who get most impacted, and that then sets in turn populist kind of policies, an American first agenda that then is not very good for long run global growth.
But again, I think that there is this problem about shareholder value and the fact that most of the vehicles for enterprise globally have a legal construct around limited liability. So if we look at the UK collapse of the company Carillion,
it's in the last week or so.
Yes, exactly. And they're running a lot of big, important infrastructure projects and services for the UK government. That was entirely a corporation that was driven by shareholder value with a leadership who were rejoicing in a limited liability model, and there's no downside, so that there is no reason for them not to take risk. And I think that sort of mentality, whether you max it up to the way that global banks behave or down into a rather small domestic agenda, this idea that the only way we can make capitalism, we need to set it free and allow people just to indulge their utility and their selfishness and the invisible hand and competition will make it all right, means we've got ourselves into a situation where the engine that's driving this thing is about rapacious capitalism, cut back to its absolute minimum around just trying to jack up share price, behaving really badly and irresponsibly globally.
Kishore, when you hear all of this, I mean, you're saying that what you're saying is the sources of inequality in the emerging markets are not the same as the ones that you're seeing in developed markets.
I would say certainly the challenges faced by the emerging markets, if you want to call them, or developing countries, if you want to call them, are definitely different from the one that developed societies are facing. Because, you know, in the case of developed societies, you've already, in a sense, have had large middle classes who unfortunately have seen a stagnation of incomes over the past few decades. And so that's a very unique problem that is faced by the developed societies. And of course, I can understand why it creates a lot of political anger. I can understand how it leads to the election of Donald Trump. And I would say that's not the kind of problem that the developing societies are facing, because they still haven't got that broad-based middle class yet. If you talk to the leaders and ask them what their priorities are, from their point of view, their priorities is to try and sustain the economic growth rates, because they find with growth rates maintaining a steady pace each year, they can increase the budget for education, they can increase the budget for healthcare. As a result of that, you get the effects that Minush pointed out, that you can now feed children in school, you get better educational results, and so on and so forth. So there's a kind of a virtuous circle that is still working in many developing countries. And so the narrative, therefore, that you will hear when you travel to these countries is not a focus as much on rising inequality, which they see as tomorrow's problem, more a focus on how you maintain the growth to ensure that the people at the bottom continue to rise up above the absolute poverty levels.
But as you say, inequality is rising in countries like China. What level of inequality, then, is acceptable?
Let me be even more blunt. The amount of wealth that the 1% has accumulated is obscene. I mean, let's be very clear about that. I mean, no human being needs $30 to $40 billion. Come on, that's absurd, right? Okay, some of them may want to give their money away, like Bill Gates and Melinda Gates are giving their money away. But if you notice that their share of wealth never goes down, and I'm always very curious to find out how is it, their wealth remains at $60 billion even though they're being so generous. it's a great mystery. By the end of the day, you still got to ask the question, how do you redistribute money from the obscene 1%? But that, I would say, is a very specific, unique, contemporary problem that has actually exploded in the last decade or so.
Eve, when it comes to inequality, how much inequality is acceptable, if there is such a figure?
Well, I think we do have to take the long view on this and remember that when they were building the beautiful cathedrals of Europe, you know, there was incredible wealth at the top and absolute poverty at the bottom, and we are always going to have that spread. I think what this gives us an opportunity to do is, as a world, to look at these statistics and say, is this what we want? And I think what we're hearing loud and clear is it feels uncomfortable, it feels unjust, and it feels like we should do more to try and spread the wealth around. So rather than railing against the top 1% or feeling desperate about the bottom 50% who we know are doing better than we had thought, which is really good news, is to say, well, what can we in the middle, those people who are not outrageously wealthy but have the sorts of jobs that mean we can be at Davos, what can we do to try and make sense of this? And I do think that there are a lot of developing countries where possibly the governments and processes aren't in place yet to be able to do those things which will encourage participation in the economy, which will skill people up, all those things. Yet first world companies who are putting their factories there or putting their retail outlets there do have this know-how. They could help. So I'd be all for getting back to those Victorian models of sort of Cadbury building factories and schools and things, because that is something
could the private sector doing it?
Absolutely. I think there could be a lot more of that, because by all means, governments, please do more. And because governments are lobbied by the wealthy, they can't always do everything as fast as many individual corporations can. So while all these people are at Davos worrying about their eternal souls and whether they should be doing more, yes, please, let's do a lot more.
Desmond, what do you make of that?
I'm rather surprised that we haven't mentioned the case of the United States, where we've just had the largest tax cut in 30 years that's going to add something like $1.5 trillion to the country's debt. And the way in which that tax cut was structured is that corporations got permanent tax cuts. Their taxes were cut from something like 35% to 20%, whereas the average householder gets a temporary tax cut that is going to fade away. So my take is, in the United States, rather than doing something to reduce income inequality, we've just had a major policy initiative that is going to make that inequality worse.
But it's also seen, isn't it, by the IMF, and I think in its latest report forecast, as seen as something that will increase growth in America.
Well, that is very questionable, because economists, whatever their political persuasion are, would think that you only have budget stimuluses, you only move towards larger deficits when the economy is weak. You don't add to debt when the economy is strong. You don't go and increase your budget deficit. Otherwise, you're going to develop a debt problem. You're going to create huge problems for the Federal Reserve in terms of raising interest rates that then risks bursting bubbles around the globe. This is a rather ill-advised fiscal policy, both in terms of demand management in the cycle, but the longer-term problem of exacerbating income inequality in a country that you've already seen the political fallout from, that to me doesn't seem to make much sense. If we now have another recession, or we now have a worsening of income inequality, I shudder to think what the political fallout of that is going to be.
Kishore, is this something that people are discussing at Davos?
Very much so. And I think, can I add one point? And this may sound like a defense of the Davos men.
Go ahead.
At the end of the day, what I liked about Macron's speech was that he emphasized that the business community must be part of the solution. It's very easy in instances like this to sort of say, hey, you guys, you know, you're sucking away the money and so on and so forth. But they're also contributing to growth. And for example, I can tell you one of the biggest priorities, if you had heard Prime Minister Modi speak in Davos, the main message he tried to convey to the Davos business community was come and invest in India. He knows very clearly that the only way you can actually continue the process of reducing poverty in India is if you get larger and larger amounts of foreign investment. And so when he makes a pitch to the businessmen to come to India to invest, and of course to invest, they've got to make money. So part of the whole process of poverty alleviation and poverty reduction, that has to be factored into the picture, because you cannot alienate the business community if you're going to succeed in poverty reduction.
We'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Kishore Mahbubani, formerly Dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore. Also in Davos was Minoush Shafiq, Director of the London School of Economics. Here in our London studio was Eve Poole, author of a book called Capitalism's Toxic Assumptions. And in Washington, Desmond Lachman, Resident Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. That brings us to the end of this edition of In the Balance. We're back again at the same time next week.